Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the terrorist attacks in Kenya and Pakistan that targeted Christians and non-Muslims, and look into the increasingly dangerous environment for humanitarian and aid organizations as they try to address the underlying problems that cause states to fail and then become havens for terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda. James Jennings, the president of Conscience International, joins us to discuss the growing challenges of operating in Somalia and Pakistan. And then we'll speak with Flint Leverett, who served as a senior director of Middle East Affairs on the National Security Council and is the co-author of Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. We'll discuss possible diplomatic openings between the U.S. and Iran as world leaders meet at the United Nations to address the General Assembly and to find a way to proceed on the Russian-American framework for controlling and destroying Syria's chemical weapons arsenal. Then finally, we'll speak with Michael Cohen, a columnist for the UK Guardian and a former chief speechwriter for the United States representative at the United Nations. We will discuss the role that Samantha Power now has representing the United States and how behind-the-scenes and backroom deals can be arranged and orchestrated between heads of states not on speaking terms who need to address common challenges. And joining us now is James Jennings, founder and president of Conscience International, a humanitarian aid organization that worked during the worst of the Somalia famine in 2010 and 2011 in the refugee camps on the Ethiopian-Somali border, as well as in the giant camp for Somali refugees in Kenya. The group also has a representative on the ground in Peshawar, Pakistan, where a reported 85 people have been killed at a bombing at the All Saints Church, which Jennings is also familiar with. Since founding Conscience International in 1991, he has demonstrated his conscience in action by responding to emergency humanitarian needs in more than 30 countries. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Jennings.
Thank you.
And it seems to me that given the sectarian nature of these two outrageous attacks in the mall in Nairobi, where Al-Shabaab terrorists yelled out to everybody, all the Muslims stand up, and gave them safe passage out. And then one of the Al-Shabaab turned to an Indian gentleman and asked him the name of the Prophet Muhammad's mother, and the man couldn't answer the question, so he was shot dead at point-blank range. And then, of course, you have the bombing of the church in Peshawar, Pakistan, that killed 85 people, and it's outraged the Christian minority community there. So there's no question that there's sectarian nature to a lot of this bloodshed, but how do you get around this conundrum where it's increasingly dangerous for you and other humanitarian aid organizations to work in countries like Somalia and Pakistan to address the underlying problems that cause these states to become failed states and then become havens for terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda? So that seems to me a vicious circle.
It is indeed, and I think you've put it very well, that in fact it's the horns of a dilemma. It's very difficult to work under those circumstances, and yet that's where the need is greatest, and the call to do something is most pressing. So I think I understand how people react to these kinds of events, as horrific as they are and as dramatic as they are. It seems to me, though, that it is helpful to get some greater context to what is going on. Usually, after the situation subsides, one can go in and continue to do the work. The situation in Pakistan in particular was relevant because I've been to that church, and I have people working there now in that whole area around Peshawar. And during the time that I was there, and it's been a couple of years ago now, there was a huge explosion in the central market of Peshawar, and 134 people died. We were scheduled to be there that day, but instead we worked outside the city. A few days after we left, there was another explosion exactly where we had been working. So I can just reiterate that, supporting your point, that it's very dangerous to work there.
And Somalia is, of course, for all intents and purposes, a failed state. And the Al-Shabaab terrorists who took over the mall in Nairobi and held it for 3 days, They have obviously taken credit for what they're doing and said it's in response to the 4,000 Kenyan troops that it was sent in under a African force financed by the United States to drive al-Shabaab out. So what's happening on the ground in terms, can you work in Somalia?
It's possible, and there are flights that go in to Mogadishu intermittently from centers in the area, from Uganda and from Kenya and from Ethiopia. So it is possible to go there, and there are people working there now. However, it's increasingly difficult. The Harakat al-Shabaab Mujahideen, which is we call al-Shabaab, is really a an offshoot or a youth militia of the Islamic Courts Union, which was in power in Mogadishu and in Kismayu, in southern part of the country, back a few years ago. They, however, were insistent on a Sharia, strict Sharia law interpretation, and gained a lot of support for the opposition in Somalia and those countries round about by the U.S. and Ethiopia and Kenya agreeing to a policy of removing those people from power. But the youth militia, al-Shabaab, is still continuing. So when Kenya invaded, when Ethiopia invaded, then things changed on the ground in Somalia. But there is certainly retaliation for that, and this is one of those acts.
But the intervention by Ethiopia happened back in the George W. Bush administration, and that was organized by the Bush administration as a way, they thought, to stabilize Somalia. But these countries are long-time enemies, and it did nothing but make the situation worse. I mean, the Kenyan intervention happened more recently.
That's right. And in 2010-11, at the same time that the famine was taking so many victims, about 260,000 people died of the famine, according to the United Nations, and there were 2 million people displaced by that, and we worked during that period of time in all around that area. But I think that what's interesting is that the Obama administration has followed the militaristic response of the Bush administration in setting up AFRICOM, AFRICOM it's called, and developing a strategy for combating terrorism. But strategy for combating terrorism always has to be a military strategy, and that seems to have the opposite effect. It creates more, as in northern Pakistan, for example, more resistance. The more drone strikes, the more people are killed, the more resistance there is. And I think in East Africa, it's very much the same. So that's what I mean by the horns of a dilemma. You have to do something to counter these kinds of acts. And yet, the more you do, the more response there is from the other side.
And again, I'm speaking with James Jennings, the founder and president of Conscious International, a humanitarian aid organization that worked during the worst of the Somalia famine in 2010 and 11 in the refugee camp on the Ethiopian-Somali border, as well as the giant camp for Somali refugees in Kenya. The group also has a representative on the ground in Peshawar, Pakistan, where a reported 85 people have been killed by a bombing of the by suicide bombings of the All Saints Church, which Jennings is also familiar with. And since founding Conscious International in 1991, he has demonstrated conscience in action by responding to emergency humanitarian needs in more than 30 countries. Now, James, clearly the war on terror is an absurdity and a catastrophe, and it's totally counterintuitive and counterproductive. You can't have a war on a tactic. That doesn't make any sense. But what drives the Al-Qaeda and the Al-Shababs is a very identifiable ideology. And it guess where it comes from Saudi Arabia, from the Wahhabi version of Islam. And the Saudis have poured a ton of money into Pakistan, and they've destabilized that place. They've created the Taliban, and when it was in government, along with Pakistan, the only country that supported them. And they continue to fund these radical organizations in Pakistan. I don't know whether they funded the people that blew up the church, but it wouldn't be surprising. And they fund and inspire al-Shabaab. And I just don't understand why we continue to call the Saudis our allies if in the war on terror, in this era of ideological terrorism, it would seem to me that you can't win militarily, you have to win with a counter-ideology, don't you?
I certainly agree with that, and I think if you trace the origins of this whole radical ideology, it goes back actually for 200 years, at the same time George Washington was advocating the Declaration of Independence and its great themes of universal respect for human opinion, that at the same time in Arabia there were the opposite ideology was being espoused. And so you can trace that origin throughout. But I think that what is very interesting is without an ideological construct, there could not be these kinds of terror attacks. I mean, if you go to a young man in Pakistan and say to him, or in Somalia, I want you to just go and kill indiscriminately civilians, innocent people, most of them would say, you know, why should I do that? I don't want to do that. But if you say to them, there is a provocation of the drone strikes on the other side and all of this, then there would be a response, yes, I'll go and fight for that ideology. So it works both ways. And so the more militaristic the response is, the militarized response, then the asymmetrical terror tactics come into being. And it reminds me of Hercules fighting the Hydra, which had so many heads, 100 heads, he had to crush each one of them at a time. It's like when you attack one place, you may spring 100 enemies. And I think it has to be fought on the ideological front, as you've said.
So the al-Shabaab, who follow the Wahhabi version of Islam, which, you know, the Saudis have used an enormous amount of their petrodollars to propagate their ideology and capture an awful lot of Islam around the world, and the royal family uses religion as a way to hold on to power. They're free to have a decadent lifestyle in the West and live behind these huge palaces and do God knows what. But meanwhile, outside those walls of the palaces, the religious police keep the entire society oppressed through the most stringent rules and regulations that oppress the people to the point where they can't even think beyond religion in order to become even political, and that nobody can vote in that country, or all they can do is depend upon the largesse of the king if they're lucky enough to get an audience. So that's the
I think if you follow the money, that would be a very interesting theme, as you have mentioned. And in Pakistan in particular, the Deobandi madrasas are multiplied and have over a number of years. But if you go back and look at the British occupation of the Indian subcontinent, that they were fighting the extremists in the same areas that these incidents are happening now. So there is a long tradition of a very militant ideology in that part of the world that is perhaps connected with the original extremism, but it certainly takes its own form in each of these countries.
Well, I'm wondering, though, since the Saudi money behind a lot of this, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, et cetera, what they've targeted in Pakistan, and particularly in the Swat Valley, and what Al-Shabaab has targeted in Somalia are the Sufi shrines, which they've destroyed in both countries.
And exactly, yes. And the Shia in Badakhshan, which is an area of Pakistan.
And they routinely murder Shia in Pakistan. So I guess my question is, as a counterweight, since you have to deal with ideology and not this idea that you can kill your way out of this problem, which the U.S. seems to have,
right?
That's a road to hell. But what about the idea that you could somehow revive Sufism to neutralize Wahhabism? Is there a strategy there?
I think that it's, by its nature, a weaker, more philosophical kind of approach. And the Sufis are growing in strength in certain areas. In Turkey, there's a very strong movement. But certainly not sufficient. It's always been a minority in Islam, and not sufficient to challenge the reigning ideologies, and I think particularly young people who are unemployed or underemployed are attracted to muscular ideologies and are easily led into these kinds of things. But I think you're right when you say that the money does a great deal of mischief, and it's easy for people to give money to those kinds of extremist organizations and yet say, my hands are clean. And that really has been something that the U.S. government has tried to track. Whether successfully or not, I think, is debatable.
Well, the only people that we know that give money to al-Shabaab is the country of Eritrea. And they seem to support al-Shabaab because their rival and enemy, Ethiopia, supports the Somali government.
Exactly. And my experience in Eritrea is that the government there is extremely repressive, and they have no, I mean, it's a Marxist government. They have no particular love for Islamic extremists, but they do have their own reasons for doing supporting al-Shabaab. And it means that not just East Africa, which is very convoluted in its politics, and I think the fact that these people struck in Nairobi means that they are intent on exporting the violence to the cross borders in that area, and you can expect to see more of these kinds of things. That's only in East Africa. If you go to the sub-Saharan Sahel in the West, you'll find that Mali and the other countries are also disturbed by these kind of ideological issues. But I think the people who really know most about Africa keep pointing out that if you just look at the terrorism as a symptom and try to crush it, you're not looking at the whole picture, and it cannot be successful. It has to be partly political, partly ideological, partly economic approach to deal with these kinds of things, you know, before they get to the point of such radical extremism.
Well, of course, we were goaded into an endless war by this hopeless fanatic, Osama bin Laden, and the Bush administration literally played right into his hands, right into his playbook. They fulfilled what he was saying, is that the Christian armies want to come and invade your country. So George Bush obliged by sending Christian armies in invading Muslim countries. And isn't that at the heart of this notion of falling into a strategy? In other words, the bin Ladens of this world want a clash of civilizations, don't they? And there are right-wing nuts on our side, too, and racist Islamophobes who also want a clash of civilization. But
yes,
that's the trap, isn't it?
And it was very distressing to see the rush to war that the Bush administration, using the neocon playbook, neoconservative playbook, was very eager to get involved in that and brought the biggest percentage of American population along with them. It would be hard to find American people right now who claim that that was the right action. But those of us who opposed the war from the beginning saw that, just as you said, this horrible scenario was unfolding, and the like a sumo wrestler being pushed off balance, the U.S. as a giant government fell right into the trap. And if you measure what the economic impact on the United States has been, not just even considering the military, the bin Laden strategy was brilliantly successful.
Well, just in closing, James Jennings, what's your sense then of whether we're going to have a more enlightened policy? I mean, once states fail, it's pretty hard to put them back together again. I mean, God knows how much we spent in the last 11, 12 years in Afghanistan, but there's not much to show for it. And Somalia, of course, is even worse, and the destruction there is so nihilistic, as far as I understand, that the al-Shabaab, you know, poison wells, they destroy infrastructure. There's something psychotic and crazy about what's going on. So how do you reverse that?
That's exactly right. I think that all I can say is that you've described a part of the problem, but it's even maybe bigger than that, which is more a pessimistic outlook. And that is, there's an Arab proverb that says, a fool threw a stone into a well, 100 wise men could not get it out. The problem is maybe bigger than that, because once the U.S. has imposed sanctions on countries like Iran, then it's very difficult to retrieve those sanctions. And now the Treasury Department has had its own war against, economic war against Iran and North Korea, and they're going using powers outside of government and much more extensive and beyond government. Once you get those economic sanctions by all the banking system around the world in place, it's very difficult to reverse them. So I see a spiral, and I see the war lasting for a very long time. I'm sorry to be pessimistic about that, but you're right. I think that the Bush administration were eminent fools to rush in where angels fear to tread.
Well, James Jennings, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with James Jennings, who's the founder and president of Conscience International, a humanitarian aid organization that worked during the worst of the Somalia famine in 2010 to 2011 in the refugee camp on the Ethiopia-Somali border, as well as in the giant camp for Somali refugees in Kenya. The group also has a representative on the ground in Peshawar, Pakistan, where a reported 85 people have been killed at suicide bombings at the All Saints Church, which Jennings is also familiar with. Since founding Conscience International in 1991, he has demonstrated conscience in action by responding to emergency humanitarian needs in more than 30 countries. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about diplomatic possibilities behind the scenes at the UN.
Messages, victims and Christians both drinking blood, and they'll pray for the destruction of all hatred, more often just those with hate for us. 'Cause it hurts when you discover one's worse and one's better to suffer or cause others to. And you can live by your conscience. Now guilt is a concept you know.
Until that day, the dream of lasting peace, world citizenship, rule of international morality, will remain in but a fleeting illusion to be pursued but never attained. Now everywhere is war.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Flint Leverett, who's a professor of international affairs at Penn State University. From 1992 to 2003, he served as senior director for Middle East affairs at the National Security Council, on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements over Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He is the co-author of Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Flint Leverett.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to talk with you.
And the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Zarif, met today with the EU Foreign Policy Chief, Catherine Ashton. And apparently they're going to meet later with the P5 plus one group, the foreign minister. That'll mean he'll be meeting with John Kerry sometime later this week. But I guess the real expectation or rumors or hopes are swirling around the possibility that President Obama and President Rouhani might meet. What odds do you give on that?
Actually, at this point, I think the odds are reasonably good for some sort of, how should I say, you know, carefully staged casual encounter. I wouldn't expect it to be a very substantive exchange. You know, the speculation is about essentially a kind of very choreographed accidental meeting. But I think at this point, there's been so much speculation about the possibilities of that, so much of a drum roll, that if it doesn't happen, that could end up being interpreted as signaling things that I'm not sure either side really wants to send at this point. So if I had to bet money, I'd bet at least a certain amount that the odds are better than not, that there'll be some sort of brief encounter.
Well, Flint Leverett, there may well be, it may be an accident of architecture, because the General Assembly main hall is closed for renovations, and they're all meeting in this temporary building, and in the narrow hallways in the cramped offices of the UN North Lawn building. So that could facilitate a, you know...
It could well make the architecture of accident easier to pull off. That's right.
So let's talk about the where we got to the position we are, since as Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, said that Syria is going to dominate the agenda.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that we got to this point with Syria with the so-called Lavrov-Kerry deal. It started with Kerry's offhand remark at a press conference in London, where he was asked what could Syria do to avoid U.S. bombing, and he said, well, they could give up their chemical weapons and do it in a week, and that's not going to happen. My understanding is that the Iranians immediately seized on that, got behind the scenes, got Assad to agree to it, and then allowed the Russians to take credit for it, knowing that they're kind of kryptonite. So is that your understanding of how we got to this position we're in?
I think that there was a very important Iranian role in particularly in persuading President Assad in Damascus to go ahead with this deal. The chemical weapons issue is a very, very sensitive one for Iran. During the 8 years of the Iran-Iraq war, when Saddam Hussein invaded the fledgling Islamic Republic back in the 1980s, Iran was subjected to years of Iraqi chemical weapons attacks, literally years. Over 100,000 people were killed or seriously injured in those attacks. There are still tens of thousands of surviving victims of chemical weapons attacks in Iran today. And with that experience, you know, Iran has, I'm not trying to question its sincerity, but it has been a very, very important and in some ways effective part of its public diplomacy to present itself as a victim of chemical weapons attacks, attacks that, to, I think, as an American, to U.S. Shame, the United States blocked any Security Council action to investigate for years. And so they've been able to present themselves as the victims, to present the United States as in some ways hypocritical or, let's say, ambivalent about the chemical weapons issue. And so if one of its close partners in the region, like Syria's Assad government, is accused of using chemical weapons, this is obviously a very, very sensitive issue for Iran. And I think they saw an opportunity here to, in a sense, remove the threat of U.S. military action in a way that's consistent with its own agenda, which is to promote the removal of chemical weapons, especially from the Middle East, and to do so in a way that actually, you know, increased the chances for more productive regional diplomacy. And I should say the Iranians remain very concerned, as the Russians do, that it's not just the Assad government that has chemical weapons in Syria. They believe, and I've talked to both Russian and Iranian officials about this, and I think that this is a genuine assessment on their part, that there is considerable evidence that there are opposition elements that have homemade sarin, have homemade chemical munitions, which they have used at various points already. And both Iran and Russia, but especially Iran, are interested in getting some international effort in place to tackle that problem as well. And I think from an Iranian perspective, if they could be seen as helpful players in encouraging the Syrian government's chemical disarmament, it puts them in a stronger position to push for international consideration, international action about chemical weapons that and capabilities that might be held by other parties in this conflict.
Again, I'm speaking with Flint Leverett, who's a professor of international affairs at Penn State University. From 1992 to 2003, he served as senior director for Middle East affairs at the National Security Council, on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements over Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He's the co-author of Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. Now, just in terms of the atmospherics building up to this chance meeting, perhaps tomorrow, perhaps on Tuesday at the United Nations, where both President Obama and President Rouhani are going to be there, Rouhani's just released 80 prisoners on top of 11 that were released earlier. He's had an exchange of letters with Obama, which he said is very positive. He wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post. It would seem to me that if a deal was made, obviously there's tremendous acrimony going back to the takeover of the U.S. embassy, and prior to that, all the way back to the CIA coup against Mossadegh. But the long and the short of it is, it seems to me that if the U.S. and Iran are able to turn this hostility, it's like the two magnets, instead of repelling, will attract. If it could be a quantum change, don't you think, that could really have profound effects on the Middle East and on U.S. Future foreign policy? I'm not suggesting that's going to happen, but would you agree?
I think it would absolutely have a profound effect on regional dynamics, and I think it would have a profoundly beneficial effect on the U.S. position, which has been in, I think, rather serious decline for a number of years. In our book, Going to Tehran, that's really why my wife and I wrote this, based on our experience in government service. We saw, even when we were in government in the 90s and the early 2000s, how much the United States could benefit from a constructive relationship with Iran, how much the Iranians helped us dealing with Afghanistan, the Taliban, al-Qaeda in the immediate wake of 9/11. I think in many ways we squandered those benefits and squandered the opening that Iranian cooperation with us represented. But I think since then, the imperatives for the United States to realign with Iran, there's basically no major issue in the region right now. There's no way we can advance, towards some kind of positive solution on any of these issues, whether it's Afghanistan, Syria, nuclear proliferation, what have you. We can't do what we say we want to do without a better relationship with Iran. And I think for the Iranians, too, they have fundamental national security and foreign policy problems which they can't solve, or at least can't optimally solve, absent better relations with the United States. Structurally, this is overdetermined. This should have happened a long time ago. There are a lot of reasons why it hasn't, but it really should happen. I think it would be profoundly in the interests of both countries, and I think it would have a lot of really powerful, beneficial effects on the Middle East.
Well, it seems to me that we have been in denial for so long about this sick relationship we have with Saudi Arabia. And that, to me, is at the heart of it. We were just talking earlier about Somalia. The al-Shabaab people were financed and created by the Wahhabis. The first thing they did was to destroy the Sufis, And the Iran, Russia, and the U.S. has something in common in Syria. Absolutely. They don't want those crazy people ending up creating a Somalia on the Mediterranean. But it seems to me, no matter where you go, you see the hand of this al-Qaeda-like fundamentalism. It's alive and well. It's flourishing. And it has an address, and that's Saudi Arabia. And they're just pretending that they're our friends. And I think because of the oil, we're just blinding ourselves to the malignant nature of this regime.
I think we are in denial about the extent and the consequences of Saudi promotion of this intensely Salafi jihadi variant of Sunni Islam. I mean, the Saudis have been promoting this kind of Islam for years, decades, really. And it has caused us significant security problems before. You know, the 9/11 attacks are a good example of that. But, you know, since the Arab Awakening started at the end of 2010, beginning of 2011, Saudi promotion of this kind of Islam and of groups espousing, and especially violent groups, I think has really intensified, because the Saudis are deathly afraid. Their biggest concern about the Arab Awakening is that you might actually have Islamist governments that would emerge in countries like Egypt, or possibly even in Syria, that would emerge basically through election, through popular choice. And from a Saudi perspective, if Muslims in the Middle East can elect Islamists, then why do you need a king in Saudi Arabia? The whole argument for monarchical rule in Saudi Arabia is this is how you guarantee proper Islamic belief, proper Islamic practice, at least as the Saudis profess to understand that. And if you can get that through elections, the whole argument for monarchical rule in Saudi Arabia breaks down. And so this is a nightmare scenario for the Saudis. And the way that they have coped with it is to promote this much more radicalized, much less tolerant, much more violent kind of extreme jihadi Islam, the sort that you see in Al-Shabaab, the kind that you see in the worst elements of the Syrian opposition. And this is really, I think, doing very bad things for the region. I think it is harmful to U.S. interests in the region. And ultimately, you know, these groups are going to come back and bite us. You know, the fact
that... Well, they already have, Flint.
Sure, they already have, but it's going to get worse.
Right.
And you're right, we are basically, because of our presumed alliance with Saudi Arabia, we are really turning a blind eye to this.
Right.
And it means you can't get into a serious negotiating process on Syria. It just, you know, in situation after situation in the region, it's just making already bad things worse.
And, of course, now you have the irony that the Saudis and the Israelis are working together to revive the military government in Egypt and
that's right.
And forestall, or if not erase, the democratic opening there.
That's right, because from a Saudi perspective, you know, they would rather have secular authoritarians ruling, as in Egypt with the military. They would rather have secular authoritarians ruling than democratically elected moderate Islamists. The, you know, democratically elected moderate Islamists are the worst case for the Saudis, and they will promote these extreme Islamists as an alternative, or as we've seen in Egypt, they will work with the Israelis, with others, to help the Egyptian military stage a coup and suppress the Muslim Brotherhood.
And presumably they don't support the dictatorship in Syria because of religion, right?
I mean, I think the main reason they don't like the Assad government. I mean, they have turned it in their propaganda. They've turned it into a sectarian fight, that the Assads come from this offshoot of Shia Islam. But the real issue is geopolitical, that Syria is aligned with Iran. And Syria believes, Saudi Arabia believes, that if they can take down the Assad government, it hurts Iran, it hurts Hezbollah, and they're concerned that if Saudi Arabia doesn't support these more extreme Islamist groups, you might have more moderate groups, like Muslim Brotherhood kinds of groups in the Syrian opposition, come to the fore. And they don't want, the Saudis don't want that either. And so the Saudi way of pressing their campaign against the Assads in Syria is to support the absolute worst elements of the Syrian opposition, the groups that, you know, even the other opposition groups can't deal with and are starting to get attacked by. And
so,
it's just making this conflict in Syria all the bloodier and harder to resolved through any kind of political process.
So just in the last couple of minutes, though, it would seem to me that the Iranians have done some things that have upset the Americans, and you know, not the least of which was the hostage crisis, the bombing of the Marines, barracks, the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, and a number of other terrorist attacks. Now, this guy, Rouhani, comes out of the Quds and out of the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps. So it's kind of like a Nixon-China thing. If anybody can tell the radicals to back off inside Iran, then he's the guy to do it. And it would seem to me at the end of the day they're a much more rational and reasonable regime to deal with than the Saudis ever will be. So is that what's your analysis on that?
I think that's right. I think that the Iranians really do have a political system that's not wrapped up with a monarchy. It's not wrapped up with a particular family. It really is a system with various competing power centers and factions. And I think that it's also the case that with Rouhani, you know, he's oftentimes kind of superficially characterized as a reformist. And in an Iranian context, that's not really correct. I would describe him as, you know, a moderate conservative, maybe a pragmatic conservative. And you're right, he has very, very close ties to the Iranian national security establishment in a way that prominent reformist politicians usually don't have. And I think that does make him a potentially very, very valuable and effective interlocutor on the Iranian side. If the United States really wants to do a nuclear deal that is grounded in the Non-Proliferation Treaty, would recognize Iran's right to enrich uranium under safeguards and then focus the negotiations on, okay, what are the safeguards under which Iran will be operating? You know, this is the team on the Iranian side with which to do that deal, with Rouhani and with his foreign minister, Javad Zarif. They are the A-team for doing that kind of deal. You know, I just hope that the Obama administration is really willing to face down hardliners here, face down the Israel lobby here, face down those in Obama's own party who basically take a neoconservative line on Iran, insists that, you know, they can't spin a centrifuge under any circumstances, everything has to be dismantled. You know, that's just going to doom diplomacy to failure. And I hope Obama will have the political and strategic wherewithal to face that down and actually engage with Rouhani and Zarif in a serious way. If he does, we could see a nuclear deal, see the beginning of a serious realignment of U.S.-Iranian relations with, as I said earlier, enormously profound effects on the U.S. position in the region.
Well,
if Obama isn't willing to face down those domestic constraints, you know, this won't really amount to much in the end, and that would be a real missed opportunity for the United States.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Flint Leverett.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Flint Leverett, who's a professor of international affairs at Penn State University. From 1992 to 2003, he served as senior director for Middle East affairs at the National Security Council, on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements over Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He's the co-author of Going to Tehran, Why the United States Must Come to Terms with the Islamic Republic of Iran. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations about how to engineer a backroom meeting.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Cohen, who's a fellow at the Century Foundation and a columnist at the UK Guardian, where he writes a regular feature on politics and national security. He's the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shape Modern America. And previously he served in the United States Department of State as chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Cohen.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And starting on Tuesday, the world leaders will be giving speeches in a temporary building since the General Assembly is being renovated. Starting off with Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff, who canceled her recent meeting at the White House over her anger at NSA spying on her and other Brazilians. She's followed by Obama. Do you think Dilma Rousseff's going to go to town on the NSA? I think that's the expectation, isn't it?
I mean, I suppose it's possible. It's a really, I think that's a interesting story in itself, that she is, I think, very much playing to domestic politics in making this an issue. And it's a really unfortunate byproduct of some of the leaks that have come out that it's put a crimp in U.S.-Brazilian relations over this.
Well, but our allies aren't too happy about it neither, and foreign businesses aren't that do business with the United States. So,
well, I mean, look, yeah. Here's the reality. Everybody knows this goes on, and everyone does it. The Brazilians do it, the Russians do it, the Chinese do it all the time, certainly more than we do. So this isn't a huge surprise, I think, that this kind of surveillance is going on. The problem is that once it becomes public, then Democrats, like the leaders, have to respond to it or look as if they are sort of just stooges of the U.S. So that, I think, explains the reaction more than anything else. I mean, the Brazilian government engages in quite a bit of its own domestic surveillance of its own population. So I don't say it's hypocrisy, but I think it's a political reaction that she is having to this. And, you know, it's understandable. But it's one that I think is rather unfortunate. I think there's much bigger, more important issues between the U.S. and Brazil that are going to get sidetracked because of this situation.
So let's talk about Samantha Power, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., and how do you think, since you was chief speechwriter for Bill Richardson, if you were advising the U.N., U.S. representative to the U.N., and the task was to somehow set up an impromptu casual meeting in the corridor somewhere between these two states that aren't speaking to each other, how do you go about that?
Well, first of all, I think it'd be well above the pay grade of the speechwriter.
I agree, but just
well above the great pay grade of the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. I mean, this is an incredibly fraught with symbolism kind of moment, you know, and you want to do this in a way, I think, that looks somewhat almost casual and it doesn't seem overly planned, and it's somewhat informal. The idea here is not what they say or what actually comes out of it, even if it's a brief meeting. It's really the symbolism of these two individuals representing, you know, two sworn enemies coming together and maybe shaking hands, taking a photo, what have you. I think, you know, that's what this is all about, and I expect that will happen tomorrow or the next day or so. And it will be an incredibly important moment, I think, a long overdue moment between these two countries, in which there's been this acrimony for, you know, 35 years almost. And I think this has the potential to really create a diplomatic breakthrough between the U.S. and Iran that could have far-reaching consequences, positive consequences.
And in terms of what's on the agenda, apart from the speeches from all of the heads of state, the UN Secretary General has basically said that Syria is really on the agenda. Let's be clear, the use of chemical weapons in Syria is only the tip of the iceberg. The suffering in Syria must end. Samantha Power has basically said the Security Council the world needs to deal with the Syrian crisis is not the Security Council we have. How do you get around that?
You don't, unfortunately. I mean, I think you deal with the issue that you have right in front of you, which is the chemical weapons issue. And I think there you have potential for the UN and for the Security Council to play a very active and leading role. If you look at the agreement that was signed by the U.S. and Russia, the Security Council basically will be responsible, secretariat will be responsible, for confirming Syrian compliance with the deal, which so far appears to be pretty positive. As the most recent, the first... submission by the Syrians about their chemical weapons stockpiles was, I think, was received rather positively. So that kind of has to be the focus right now. And I think, you know, get this one right. It's a very difficult deal in a very short time frame. But if you can get this right, if you could find a way to use the UN as a tool for confirming compliance and for eliminating these stockpiles in Syria, then maybe that creates a springboard for further diplomacy. I mean, I think that's the way you have to think about it, is a step-by-step process. You're not going to resolve the Syrian civil war anytime soon in the Security Council. And I think, frankly, it's the wrong forum to resolve it. But this is a good step forward for diplomacy in the region that involves both the U.S. and Russia.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Cohen, who's a fellow at the Century Foundation and a columnist for the UK Guardian, where he writes a regular feature on politics and national security. He's the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, The Greatest Presidential Campaign Speeches of the 20th Century and How They Shaped Modern America, and previously served in the United States Department of State as chief speechwriter for the U.S. representative to the United Nations. Now, Samantha Power, of course, comes out of the humanitarian world in the sense that she wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide. And apparently, from her position at the UN, she has, and prior to that, on the National Security Council in the Obama administration, she has been an advocate for a more assertive U.S. Response to genocide and mass murder that's gone on around the world, and in particular in Syria. And how do you think how much leeway does a UN representative have in terms of their personal feelings and yet the national policy? Because let's face it, the U.S. has stood by while 120,000 plus Syrians have died and basically done nothing.
I don't know if I agree with that. Actually, I think first of all, let's be clear that the options for the U.S. are very limited, obviously, short of use of military force. But, you know, first of all, there's been support, humanitarian support for refugees. There's been efforts in the Security Council to isolate Syria, to put sanctions on Syria. There have been efforts, unilateral efforts by the U.S. to do that. There have been unilateral efforts to support the rebels. I mean, I think the U.S. has done as much as it can do, short of use of military force, to try to isolate the Assad regime, try to find a way for political solution. They have convened diplomatic meetings in Geneva to try to resolve the conflict. So I think they've done more than nothing. And the problem is there's not a lot they can do beyond that because, I think, of the Russian position on Syria, which is that, you know, to be blunt about it, the Russians want Assad to survive. And they're going to use a diplomatic muscle in the UN to try to reach that result. And I think also you have a situation on the ground that's basically a stalemate. So you don't really have an obvious way, I think, to tip the balance one way or the other. So I think, you know, there's not a lot that Samantha Power can do via the UN, a lot the U.S. can do, unless it wants to get involved militarily, and I think that probably would be a mistake, and I think after losing the view of the Obama administration that does not want to get involved in this war.
Well, Michael Cohen, all the Syrian experts that I speak to all seem to agree that something maybe could have been done very early when the spontaneous rebellion broke out, before the jihadis came in at the, you know, the Saudi-financed jihadis who've entirely played into Assad's hands, because his basic argument is it's me or the terrorists, and these heart eaters certainly fit the bill and help Assad. But prior to that, when you still had a spontaneous revolution, at the very time when Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said Assad is going to fall soon, which certainly didn't prove to be the case, there's a belief that that was when the U.S. I'm not talking about military intervention, but wholehearted support for the rebellions and did everything in terms of isolating this mafia family that runs Syria.
Well, I think that may be true. I mean, it's sort of a counterfactual, so we can't really know for sure. I mean, I think they were pretty persistent and pretty strongly opposed to Assad and pretty strongly supportive of the rebels to a degree. I mean, they weren't providing actual military support or logistical support. I think also it's fair to say that the Syrian rebellion broke out at the exact moment the U.S. was involved in a military conflict in Libya, which may have had something to do with the fact and the president had other issues going to Washington, which may have had something to do with the fact that there wasn't as much involvement. I think just looking at the situation now, we could say what happened two years ago, but I think now there's very little the U.S. can do, I think, to turn the balance, unless, again, it wants to get involved militarily. And I think, or support the rebels in a much more, you know, robust way. But again, that brings with it all kinds of problems because, you, as you said, you've got rebels who are not necessarily fans of the U.S. and not necessarily the groups you want to see take power in Syria. I think the U.S. position has been to try to find a political settlement. It's probably the right position. I'm not sure it's going to work. But having said that, you know, I think that this deal with the Russians on the chemical weapons is a really important deal and potentially could lead the way toward larger diplomatic breakthroughs. I mean, at this point, you're not going to see much happen until both sides sort of decide that they have more to gain from talking than do from fighting. I don't think you've reached that point yet. And you have, as you said, you have support on both sides. You have support for the rebels from the Saudis and others, and you have support from the Syrians from Iran and from Russia. It's hard to see, again, unless the U.S. takes a more active role, how you tip the balance one way or the other. And again, do you want to tip the balance toward the rebels? I'm not sure the U.S. does either. There's not an obvious black hat and white hat situation here.
Sure. Well, but if the U.S. and Iran start on a different path, that in itself could change. I mean, apparently Iran is the one country that has probably more influence over Syria than any other country.
Oh, absolutely. And I will say this, that the Syrians are probably not thrilled to see this charm offensive from the Iranians because, you know, they're, for obvious reasons, they rely on the Iranians. There's a strong cultural connection between the two countries. You know, but the Iranians were not happy with these chemical weapons. They have their own history with that, and from being attacked by chemical weapons by Saddam Hussein in the 80s during the Iran-Iraq War. So I think that this diplomatic outreach could be problematic for the Syrians. They could see this as somehow the U.S. sort of ironically, I mean, it's sort of surprising to even say this, but the U.S. sort of taking the Iranians, you know, off the field somewhat. I doubt that would happen that far, but you certainly, I think, that would cause concern among the Syrians. And again, that. Just the fact that you have diplomatic breakthrough, diplomatic negotiation between the U.S. and Iran may lead the Syrians to conclude that their long-term better deal is to sort of, is talk than to keep fighting. That's one possibility that may come out of this whole situation with Rouhani and with Obama. The Syrians made their calculus may change, and that's one positive. That's really going to be one positive outgrowth that would occur.
Well, Michael Cohen, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Always a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Cohen, who's a fellow at the Century Foundation and a columnist at the UK Guardian, where he writes a regular feature on politics and national security. He's the author of Live from the Campaign Trail, the greatest presidential campaign speeches of the 20th century and how they shape modern America. And previously he served in the United States Department of State as chief speechwriter for the U.S. representatives to the United Nations. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Colin Black. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.